Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are you afraid of? And does that fear protect you from real hazards or simply hold you back from achieving and experiencing the best life has to offer? Having grown up as a shy kid, Jamal Yogis was always curious about the nature of fear. As a journalist adult, Yogis decided to pursue the answers to his questions with everyone from neuroscientists and psychiatrists to meditation teachers and shark divers. Along the way, he gained perspective on the mechanisms of human fear and on the growth that can come from staring down and even embracing some of the things that fill us with anxiety. Jamal Yogis shares what he learned in his new book, The Fear Project, What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Surfing, and Love. Jamal, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much, Chris. Good to be here.
So I talked a bit about this in the introduction, but talk more, if you would, about what drew you to fear as a subject of research. What does that say about you?
Well, it was a lot of things. In the book, I talk about a breakup I was going through, and breakups are one of the most stressful things that humans endure. When you look at the divorce statistics, they affect our health incredibly, taking years off our lives sometimes. And so that was a biggie, but if I can go back a little bit to 2009, my first book had come out, and I had this like 30 bookstore tour, and I dread public speaking, as millions of others do. And so I sort of used all these tools to try to calm myself down. I brought my friend's band with me. They would play a few songs before I went on. I would do some meditation beforehand, and I was still very nervous, and I bombed the first few. But around the fifth book reading, I started having a lot of fun. I started relaxing, being myself, and the rest are some of the best memories I have. And so that seemed kind of almost like magic, that something you dread could suddenly flip. And I was wondering, what other areas of my life am I shying away from, avoiding, because I'm afraid that it could be really rich? And so the book tour and the breakup kind of coincided, and I realized I had a necessity to understand this emotion. And I had this vague idea that neuroscience and psychology were making huge breakthroughs. You could look into the brain now and see which areas are lighting up. And I wanted to get in on some of that action. So I thought I'd use this excuse I have as a journalist to call up any neuroscientist and say, hey, can I ask you how my brain works? And so that's how the Fear Project began.
Well, what is fear from a physiological standpoint?
It's so interesting because we have a kind of idea about what fear is, and as separate from other emotions, but fear is actually just arousal in the body. It's alertness. It's a little bit of adrenaline, cortisol, a stress hormone that shuts down the digestion and immune system and sex drive, and it's basically saying, you need energy now, so we're going to shut down these long-term projects so that you can survive the moment. And so fear is actually just energy in the moment. You're stealing a little bit from these sort of back burner projects to survive now. And so it can be harnessed to have to make you run faster or jump higher or lift the car up off a child or something like that, or it can be panic or paralysis or some of these results that usually don't help us perform better. And so it's a double-edged sword, and fear can be good or bad.
You know, it's interesting when you described all the ways that sort of unimportant things shut down, and we have an increased stress response and increased adrenaline, things like that. It sort of makes sense when you describe it that way, that there are people who only feel, they will say, fully alive when there's a little bit of fear or chaos in their lives.
Right. We all look for different ways of getting arousal, right? I'm drinking a cup of coffee right now. That's my usual way. But you could also, anybody who's invested in the stock market knows that if there's a big day happening where the market might tank, you don't need your coffee. It's you have a natural stimulant there. And so there's in the book, I interview all these extreme athletes, people who jump off buildings and surf huge waves and And what you find talking to these people is not necessarily that they're adrenaline junkies, as they're often categorized, but that they've found a way to harness this emotion for focus in their lives. Oftentimes, they might have been a little bit ADHD as kids and had a hard time focusing, and the fear actually gave them that alertness, that narrowing of focus. That's another thing that fear does. You often hear about tunnel vision or a narrowing of focus. And so when you're relaxed, you can be a little bit more creative. The mind sort of opens, and what fear does is focus and narrow for a lot of us.
It does seem that people who are extreme athletes or who do risky things as sort of recreation are so often misunderstood by the world. And you did a great job at reminding us that these are not people who sort of go off willy-nilly and have no fear of what might happen to them. They're very careful about what they do, but they have the ability to not sort of make excuses based on fear for not doing things.
The ones I talked to did. One of the characters, Doc Reneker, is a cancer doctor, a famous cancer doctor who loves big wave surfing, and he is very plodding. He approaches big wave surfing like he does a surgery. I mean, he charts every current, and he makes sure he crosses every T and dots every I. There are those people out there who might have a death wish or who might have a more complex relationship to doing something dangerous, or they want it's more about ego or more about being the crazy one. So it's different for everyone, but I wanted to talk to the people who are doing these sports intelligently, and there are, I think the vast majority are, I didn't expect that, but as I got into my interviews, I realized, wow, these guys are not reckless. They're the opposite of that. And when you look at them in an evolutionary way, a lot of these people probably have the biology where they would have been praised for their hunting or their warrior skills. But in today's world, where we're told to sit for 8 hours a day through school and you're praised for that, and then do the same thing in an office, there isn't a lot of room to use that biology and to show it off. So these are kind of outlets for these people, positive outlets, I'd argue, to get that biology working.
Tell us a little bit about this big wave surfing. You grew up with a father who was a surfer. You surf yourself, but there was still something daunting about taking on a gigantic wave.
Oh, yeah. I never saw myself as a big wave surfer, one of these people who needed to be out on the edge or pushing the limits. I just enjoyed being in the water, and surfing became almost a religious practice for me, where every day I go out and get my exercise and I'm out in nature. But when I took on this book, I realized that one thing that conquering a fear in the physical world does is it trickles over into the rest of your life. And I started trying to push my fears or expand my comfort zone in every area of my life, and surfing became a part of that. And I sort of realized when I had a really good day out at the beach in front of my house on a bigger wave than I'm normally comfortable with, I had a little more pep in my step on land. And that extended out to, what if I took this all the way to Mavericks, which is about a wave about a half hour from my house that's known as the Mount Everest of surfing. And it had terrified me from a young age, because two of the best big wave surfers in the world have died there. There's all these legendary stories. There's great white sharks that feed there. So it was just, it was the fear of fears for me. And I probably wouldn't have done it had I not been reporting a book about fear, to be honest, but it did change my life in ways that I wouldn't have expected.
What does change when you do something that you didn't think you could, maybe you felt forced to do by this project or whatever, after you've done it? Do you feel fear in a different way if you were to go do it again?
Absolutely. I mean, that first day out at Mavericks, I watched these four-story waves go by, and they have this atomic boom when they break, and I just thought, no way. There's no way I'm going near that. And then gradually I sort of got closer, and I only rode two waves that first day in about 8 hours, and the whole rest of the time was spent basically trying to untwist my gut. But once that once I did push over that first wave and I wrote it, it changed my relationship just so much, because this wave was caught up in all these stories from my childhood. And so it was kind of like that monster that you had believed in your whole life. You got through that fear, so what else can be scary? What else can hurt you? And I was dealing at that time with, I'd fallen in love with a wonderful woman who's now my wife, and I'm terrified of commitment. My parents divorced, and I always wanted to sort of avoid marriage.
You wanted to avoid divorce, ultimately, is what...
Ultimately, yeah. I wanted to avoid divorce, but marriage was obviously linked, and I thought... I was really struggling with it, and on the drive back from my first day at Mavericks, I knew that I would propose to my now wife, and I wasn't expecting that at all. It seemed like just a contrived little project, and it kind of blew me away.
From an evolutionary standpoint, we should be clear that fear has kept the species alive.
Absolutely. I mean, my book, I got into fear wanting to dislike it. I mean, who likes fear? It's uncomfortable. It's makes you freeze up. But as I learned more about fear, I realized, wow, this is really good that we have this. It, you know, keeps me from texting while I'm driving, and keeps us from doing a lot of things. And the conclusion I came to is that there's good fears and bad fears, and our task as modern humans is differentiating between the two. And the key to doing that is understanding how our brains work, how fear is coming from a deep primal sort of lightning-fast area of the brain, and the logical and creative parts of our cortex that have developed more recently in evolution are functioning on a different time frame. They're almost speaking a different language, and we have to teach the caveman and the lumbering professor to communicate a little bit better. And so, yeah, there are plenty of good fears and plenty of bad fears, paper tigers and real tigers, and it's our task to learn how to differentiate.
And that's such an important point, because I think so many of us, and I would count myself among this group, if we don't stop and really consciously say, wait, am I afraid of this thing for a good reason? Fear of all the emotions is the one that we tend not to question, right? We're just afraid of something, so we stay away.
Yeah, I have a little phrase I've developed that you have to learn how to doubt doubt and not fear fear. But, I mean, let's break this down. There's what fear does. The brain develops like an onion, basically, and the stuff that's most necessary, fear, breathing, sexual desire, heart rate, are sort of at the core of this onion, and then the more complex skills are on the outer layer. And fear works lightning fast. So anything that causes you the slightest bit of pain, say you get bit by a dog like I did in Mexico, you might end up fearing dogs, but you might also get a queasy feeling about Mexico. And that's because this lightning fast amygdala, it's a little almond deep in the brain, it makes blanket associations. It needs to be fast because it might not have time to be precise and slow and differentiate the numbers. So it makes those blanket statements that you should be queasy about Mexico too. And so that's when you have to go in with a therapist or through meditation and observing your thoughts and say, okay, this is the false fear. This is maybe the real fear of, you know, you don't want to be around a dangerous dog, but then also differentiate again that not all dogs are dangerous. So
Jamal Yogis is with us. His new book is called The Fear Project. We'll return to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Jamal Yogis. His new book is called The Fear Project, What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Surfing, and Love. You can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Jamal, what are some of the methods that scientists use to measure human fear and to understand its effects on our bodies and our brains?
One of the coolest ones I got to participate in, Chris, was at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Daniela Schiller, a neuroscientist who studies fear, took me down into this basement, and she hooked me up to basically a fear monitor, and it measured the sweat level on my skin, and the tiniest bit of sweat can show a very light stress response. And on my other hand, she hooked me up to a zapper, sort of a la Peter Venkman in Ghostbusters. and I was about to watch this pattern of blue and yellow squares, and I quickly realized that when the blue square had appeared, sometimes I got shocked. And after just one shock blue square pairing, I was showing a lot of fear of the blue square, which was surprising because I didn't consciously feel afraid of it. I knew that the blue square was benign. It was that stupid shocker that I should be afraid of. But the brain makes this quick association. And the amazing thing is, if I were to come back into that lab a year later, if I didn't have positive blue square therapy, I'll call it, exposure therapy, I would still be afraid of that blue square. I would still show it a spike. And it only takes one reminder to sort of get your anxiety up. And what Schiller then does is give you positive blue squares without shocks repeatedly to help you overcome that fear. And that's basically what the primal brain needs. It needs to see for itself that this is safe. That's, again, going back to the miscommunication between the professor and the caveman. Talking to yourself about, oh, the blue squares are fine, you know, it's no big deal, it doesn't work, you need to see the blue squares. And then there was even some nuance about her study with memory that's really fascinating, but I don't want to go on too long.
Well, you know, the blue square experiment is interesting because it also gets to the ways in which human fear differs from animal fear, right? We know that animals can be afraid in the moment when they are threatened, but unlike us, they don't remember a time when they were 14 years old and were terrified by something, and they don't imagine something horrible in the future. They just live in the present.
That seems to be the case. I mean, we don't know everything about animal brains, and dolphins and whales may have complex future thinking ability, but it seems like most animals have a smaller prefrontal cortex, and we have this ability where we can think of innumerable horrible outcomes in the future, or good ones. But our fear systems have made us prioritize threats. So if you see a fearful face flash on a screen faster than your conscious mind can even notice it, your fear response is already triggered. Whereas if you see a happy face, it takes much longer to register. And what's happening there is if something's safe, you basically don't have to notice it. And so this is interesting, right? Because our brains are prioritizing these negatives, and now we have this future thinking capability. So we can give ourselves a huge stress response fear response that's the same as seeing a tiger or a bear, and yet nothing's actually happening at all. Mm-hmm. And so this is a huge reason why so many diseases now are stress-related for humans. One is because we're living longer, and that stress begins to accumulate in the body over time. But in a nutshell, chronic stress and fear are really bad for our health, and quick spikes of it in the moment are not so bad. They can help us have a good fear response. And so that's another one of our tasks, is learning to stay present, and the brain needs some training for that.
We are also wired to sort of catch fear from other people pretty easily. Talk about the evolutionary basis for that and how it sometimes goes too far in the modern world.
Yeah, well, it makes sense that fear spreads lightning fast. If you were in a village and somebody hears a loud noise, you see their face being afraid, and you get the fear response before you even know what the situation is. Your body gets ready to fight or flee. because you might need to act immediately. And scientists have even begun to understand that we may have the same ability as fish, where we can smell fear on each other, and the smell of fear can ignite our stress response. So when you look at this on a macro level, where we're ingesting constant threats through Twitter feeds and the news and our Facebook pages and our boss texting us on the weekend, all those threats are maybe giving us scared faces, and then we're passing those scared faces along to our neighbors and partners. And so fear can spread very quickly. And the antidote to that, as some of the psychologists I talked to told me, is basically understanding how this works so that you can start to notice when you're being duped by group fear. Because we basically want to go along with the tribe. There's a whole bunch of studies behind groupthink. And a lot of times our group fears are flat wrong and have nothing to do with our present lives. So that's it's tricky business, but it's something that we have to be aware of, or we'll just be constantly stressed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you would like to speak to my guest, Jamal Yogis. His new book is called The Fear Project. Let's go on the phone now to Chase in Denton. Hi, Chase.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, I had a question for Delta. He was speaking about fear and also talking about his loss of his girlfriend and correlating that with fear. And I just wanted to know if he considered that to be fear or something else.
Sorry, the breakup with the girlfriend, whether I consider that to be fear?
Yeah, I guess your reaction to it.
Right. Well, it's basically what is triggered by a breakup, which is insecurity, jealousy. I mean, what are those but fear, right? Jealousy is the fear that somebody else is better than you. Sadness might be the fear that you'll never clamber out of this horrible dark hole, or you'll always be alone. That fear of being alone is so huge for so many of us. So how these are actually wired in the brain is complicated, and not every fear has been mapped in the brain. But we do know that if you're feeling some of that faster heart rate, the sweat, the tight chest, the tight gut, that it involves the ancient fear center. And so some of these more complex types of thinking, jealousy and whatnot, are basically pinging off that amygdala and involving fear. And that's what we feel in our bodies, right? And that's what we want to be free of after a breakup, is that feeling, that tightness in the chest. And so I think it's absolutely related. And that's why when you overcome a fear that has nothing to do with the breakup, like surfing Mavericks or you give a great speech at your job, that it starts to meld with those other insecurities in your life and why I really encourage in this book for people to go out and do something that they feel confident in when they're in a crisis of fear.
Let's talk a little bit about the public speaking thing, because we know that this is a pretty common fear for a lot of people. I'll say that it's one that I don't share, although if I saw like a rattlesnake on a hike, I would freak out like everybody else. But the public speaking thing has to do with our fear of social isolation. Is that right?
It seems to be that. I mean, these evolutionary biologists have talked about the fact that when we were wandering around the Serengeti as tribal people, if you were ostracized from the tribe, that was a death sentence, essentially. And so it became adaptive to basically have this fear become innate, where we don't want to be shunned. Even if you don't fear public speaking, everybody wants to be loved. Everybody wants acceptance from the tribe. And when you are public speaking, you are basically saying, right now, I'm asking all of you to praise me
love
and approve
me.
And it's never that that cut and dry, usually when you're at a dinner party or something, where it's your turn to present and ask for the tribe's praise. And so it makes sense that this really freaks a lot of us out. And the good news is that there are ways to overcome that fear and to manage it and even to turn fear into a performance enhancer when you're on the podium.
But talk about some of those ways, because this is really fascinating research.
Yeah, basically the cutting edge stuff that I'm getting from Sion Bialik at the University of Chicago mostly is that it's how we relate to fear that matters, not actually if we're feeling fear. So people who feel that faster heart rate and they say, oh, this is going to be exciting, this is going to be fun, and oftentimes it's because they have positive memories to fall back on, like, oh, I remember doing well at this speech before and I'll do well again. Then fear can almost is energy in the moment, right? So it can make your speech more dynamic. It can make you run faster at the Olympics. Why are records always broken at the Olympics, the highest stress environment? It's because these athletes have learned to turn fear around in their favor. But the rest of us, we've often, say, bombed a speech, have done the deer in the headlights, and we feel that fear, and we think, uh-oh, there it is. This means bad news. And then it's basically fear on top of fear. And the fear of fear is often what characterizes anxiety disorders and panic disorders and things. Mm-hmm. So it's almost the aversion to fear that is where the performance starts to decline. And so this takes practice, and it takes practice usually in an environment doing something you love. For me, that's surfing. So if I can notice, oh, I'm afraid, and I'm going to embrace that fear in an environment where I'm actually having fun, then I can carry that over into public speaking, which is something that has not been fun in the past, but I'm working on.
Why are we sometimes, we have this fear of fear for some of us, it's paralyzing for some of us, it just is something that we have to cope with. Why do we sometimes like to be entertained by things that scare us?
Again, my theory is that it's just, it's like a drug, right? You're getting adrenaline, and you're also getting dopamine. When we do new things, basically that are sort of expanding our comfort zone, whether it's eating a new food or climbing a new mountain, and especially if that thing's a little bit risky, we get more of a squirt of dopamine in the brain, and dopamine is that pleasure chemical that makes everything fun, and it's also what you get in the brain when you do cocaine. So it's very addictive, and some people like to get that from horror movies. Other people like to get it from, you know, eating strange foods in different countries, and others like to get it from extreme sports or, you know, sex, what have you. But we all have our ways of getting dopamine, and I think those of us who have latched around scary movies or roller coasters, we might have a more thrill-seeking personality, or we might have good associations with seeing a horror movie with friends when we were 13 and it became enjoyable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Mike in Dallas. Hi, Mike.
Hi. My mom taught us growing up an acronym for fear, and I was wondering if he had heard this as far as handling fear, meaning false evidence appearing real, and I'd like to hear his comments. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I have not heard that, although I'll use it. And again, I think there are times when fear is merited, and so I don't think that acronym applies all the time, but here's where it does, is that fear is in the mind, right? It's not real. It only exists in the mind, and it ceases in the mind. And Buddhists have been talking about this for millennia, that fear is just passing through. It's impermanent, and so we have a choice whether we want to feel it or not. Whether that's true or not is interesting, but we do have a choice how we react to fear. And I think that social situations are what give a lot of us stress these days. We just don't have that many lions and tigers running around. So these social fears plague us, and those are almost always false evidence appearing real, because if you are wondering if you should go and talk to that CEO who might give you a job, or that cute girl or guy at the bar that you might fall in love with, absolutely you should go. And if fear is telling you that you might look really silly, well, that's not a very good reason to pay attention to it. And it's this old biology we're saddled with saying, don't be ostracized by the tribe, saying, don't do it. And that's lying to you. That's when fear is selling you up the river.
Does it get easier with practice, Jamal?
Absolutely. And that's the fun thing. I mean, I started with Eleanor Roosevelt's quote when I started researching fear: do one thing that scares you every day. And I started really small, and I think baby steps are the key. Talking to a stranger in the elevator if you have social anxiety, or, you know, taking a swim class if you're afraid of the water, but doing it in baby steps, and then you make it fun, and then you realize that overcoming fear is fun, and you start approaching the things that you used to shy away from. And it really seems to have some sort of magic in it, because I could tell you a countless stories of ways that just the small thing, sending an extra email to somebody I didn't think maybe I should, opened up into a big opportunity.
My guest is journalist Jamal Yogis. His new book is called The Fear Project: What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Surfing, and Love. You can join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jamal Yogis, who is author of the new book, The Fear Project: What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Surfing, and Love. Join us at 800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. Jamal, last week when I was reading the book, I did a little informal social media survey on the subject of fear and discovered that people are afraid of all sorts of things. But I was struck by the pattern that of the people who said they are less afraid today than they used to be, they were all people who had actually been forced to confront the thing that scared them the most.
That's fascinating, and it makes a lot of sense. I just wrote a piece about exposure therapy and how exposure therapy, by the data, is by far the most successful in helping people with specific phobias, anxiety disorders, panic disorders, and yet it's not prescribed frequently. There's only about 30% of PhDs are trained in exposure therapy.
Let me jump in here. Exposure therapy is like, if you're afraid of spiders, first you look at a picture of a spider till you can handle it. Then you look at a spider in a jar, that sort of thing, right?
Exactly. And so it's funny because we use this with our kids all the time, like the intuitive way to get over fear. You know, our son was afraid of his crib, and there was a point where he just wouldn't even look at his crib or without shrieking, and so I actually had to crawl into the crib and play with him in there and then show him that, you know, the crib can be fun. And so we do that with our kids intuitively, but when we become adults, it seems like we think we're too smart for it or something, and we want to just talk about our fears or avoid them altogether. And so I think if we sort of treat ourselves like babies a little bit and say, well, that still makes me uneasy, and I'm actually going to go and do it, even if it seems a little juvenile, I'm going to take that on. And you'll be amazed, I think, at the results, because it is, it's empowering. It's just, and it becomes fun. And things like phobias, I mean, of snakes, for example, can be tough because snakes were so troublesome to our ancestors that a lot of people are scared of them. And they found with exposure therapy that you're not necessarily going to want a pet snake after you're done, but you might free yourself from excessive anxiety or thinking about them when you don't need that stress in your life.
What has being a parent taught you about the nature of fear?
Well, basically, watching my son has made me realize that we all have our unique fear imprint, right? He wants to get into everything physically dangerous. He wants to leap off the side of the couch. He can't even walk yet. He wants to play with knives. But with strangers, he's pretty timid. And similar to me when I was a kid, and shyness has been shown to be fairly genetic. And so just the fact that we all come in with this unique fear imprint, and that it takes some understanding of ourselves and understanding of our brains to sort of work through that. And I'm just realizing the things that I am afraid of, because it's so convenient to just cover them up. And unless you really put a spotlight on yourself for a year and do a fear project of your own, I'm encouraging people to tweet out what their fear project will be in 2013, because it's been so helpful for me. I want everybody to try this. Just notice where fear is arising in your life. And again, watching my son, I realize how beneficial fear can be, you know, and how it's essentially compassion at sometimes trying to keep him away from the things that could harm him. But at the same time, he has so many fears that are irrational, the fears of meeting a new friend that I want to disabuse him of. So it's just, again, sort of how complex fear is, but it's certainly a gift to be a parent to get that glimpse.
Do you find you are protective of your son in ways that you didn't anticipate?
Well, when we first had him, I was having these dreams where I would literally leap across the room in the middle of the night, ready to, because I thought he was falling or I was having a dream. And that high alert protectiveness is amazing. I don't think there's a energy on the planet that is more powerful than a parent's drive to protect their child. If we could tap that, we would have renewable energy forever.
Parental fear harnessed at last, lighting up our cities.
Yeah, and it's beautiful in a way, but you have to contain it, right? You have to allow them to skin their knee and bump their head, because that's how they're going to learn. And so striking that balance is one of our challenges as parents. But again, it's learning to differentiate the good fear from the bad fear. And it is sometimes easier to do with our children. So I think we have to apply those principles that we use with our children to ourselves.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Mike on the line now in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Fear is such a motivator, and it's used. I'm in sales. What are the, if fear is, say, number one, what is number two and number three as motivators? I mean, if we want to, I personally like to use less fear in sales. And then it's, I guess the other, just a comment is that the Bible says perfect love casts out fear, and I wondered if he had used that as a remedy.
Let me jump in, Mike, before we get an answer for you. How do you use fear as a tool for sales?
I'm not going to give that away, but I'll say I've seen it used with you know, insurance, you know, you might die and leave your family destitute, so you better buy this policy.
Got it. So in other words, act now so you won't regret something later. Did you want to comment on all that, Jamal?
Yeah, thanks for the Bible quote. I actually did use that. I wasn't raised going to church, but I came across that quote a number of times, and it actually came up when I was proposing to my wife that perfect love casts without fear, and it was helpful at that moment. Fear is a motivator for sales. Certainly, we see that all the time in politics, right? Like if we don't get our fiscal house in order, the world may end. What are the other motivators? Clearly, sex is another sales motivator, and those things are at the core of the onion. Fear and sexual desire are the two most basic, probably, emotions that an organism needs to feel to survive. So those are probably going to continue to be the biggest drives for sales, but over logic and science and those things that we would like to be drivers. But I think there's a way to turn fear into a positive in sales as well, instead of structuring. I'm not in sales, so I feel a little silly giving any advice, but structure a threat in terms of a positive, saying, well, this is a way in which you'll be able to help your family, instead of saying, "Are you? What if this should happen to you?" And sort of structuring it in a positive, so that the person buying can feel like, "Well, this is the right thing to do." And it may trigger a little bit of that fear response, but it's the fear that's sort of the compassionate fear rather than the selfish fear.
Why are so many people afraid of trying something that they are not sure they'll be able to do? In other words, the fear of failure.
I think that failure is largely social, because we're afraid, what will everyone think if I move to Hollywood and try to become an actor? Mm-hmm. You know, that's so impractical. Or
so it's back to that tribal rejection.
I think it's tribal, but then also it's just the fear of loss of livelihood and not being able to support yourself. But I think there's ways to counteract this, and one of them is just playing out what would happen if you did write that screenplay. You took a year off from your normal job, and maybe you went into some debt, and you wrote it, put everything you had into it, and then you failed. Would you really not be able to go back to your job and work your way out of debt, or get two jobs, and how would that feel if you had tried? Wouldn't that be a better feeling, having tried and failed, than having always avoided and danced around it and wondered what would have happened if? And that's really what I come back to again, is the feeling of anxiety that comes from never having tried, or the feeling of helplessness that comes from never having tried, is so much worse than actually failing. And that's the key point with fear. So often what we fear, the actual moment that it's happening, it's not that bad, but the anxiety and the stewing in it is what gives us chronic stress and makes us sick. Of course, there's exceptions to that, you know, the loss of a child or things that are just so unimaginably horrible. But in most things that we desire in our lives, and the things that we, the small fears that give us stress, if that fear were to actually happen, you would find it far less bad than you're probably thinking of.
We know now that many people who experience something that is very traumatic are affected by that later on. They experience fear and anxiety and panic when these memories are triggered. Will we ever find a way to just erase the bad memories and therefore live as if they never happened to us?
Yeah, there's some fascinating research going on to that end, and Joseph Ledoux, one of the neuroscientists I interview, has done these studies where basically you can give a beta blocker or a drug that busts up proteins that need to be there for memories to consolidate, you can inject this into the brain while somebody is remembering a traumatic experience, or you can give them a pill, and that the emotional aspect of that memory can be dulled, almost as if it's erased. And those are not available on the market, but they're being tested right now, and they may become very helpful at some point, but a lot of us would find it a little creepy to take a pill to erase the pain of a traumatic memory, unless it's really debilitating. And the good news is that the same mechanisms that allow this drug to erase the trauma mean that we can also change our memories without drugs, and that is where therapy comes in. And I talk more about that in the book, because I'm not a doctor, and I didn't want to get too far into drugs. I wanted people to have these natural remedies.
Well, speaking of natural remedies, talk a little bit about the ways that meditation can be used to help us cope with fear.
Well, yeah, I mean, you bring up PTSD, as the military is doing a huge study right now on meditation and PTSD, because they found in a small group that it reduced soldiers' symptoms by about 50%, just 30 minutes a day for 8 weeks of meditation. And the mechanisms behind that are not understood completely, but one thing that's happening is that when you're breathing slowly and you're feeling safe and getting into that parasympathetic nervous system, as memories arise, as traumatic memories arise, they get associated with this feeling of equanimity and tranquility. So you're basically reassociating this trauma with the feeling during which you're remembering them, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. So a lot comes up when you're silent, when you're quiet and still. And often it's the difficult stuff, but it's almost as if meditation is a safe place for those memories to arise. And it's for a similar reason that talk therapy can work. If you're in a really supportive environment and you're bringing up these memories, it gets associated with that supportive environment. But meditation's free.
Yeah, you're sort of rebranding your fear through meditation.
Exactly.
The new book by journalist Jamal Yogis is called The Fear Project, What Our Most Primal Emotion Taught Me About Survival, Surfing, and Love. Jamal, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can download the podcast for free at kera.org/think, where you can also learn about upcoming programs. And of course, we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.